the Denisons, the Denisons, the busiest in the biz. You do know who it is, it's Dennis Quaid. That's him.
Joining me today on the Denisons is my hilarious and talented co-star from the movie Innerspace, Martin Short. Joe Dante, who directed us in the film, will also be here as I host our mini Innerspace reunion and we talk about how the movie came to be and the fun we had making it. I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. Here we are on the Denisons, and we are having a testosterone reunion of Innerspace. Yes, all guys, except for not many females.
No. Some do. Some do, though.
Yes, but I'm here with the magnificent, the wonderful, the Artur, Mr. Joe Dante.
Are you going to sing that song that Pat Kehoe used to make everybody sing?
Joe Dante.
Whoa. And Mr.
Marty Short, thank you so much.
Yes, today he's here as himself. Exactly. Marty Short. Yes. But he played Jack Putter in Innerspace. Jack Putter, not Potter. That was it is. And you have me, Dennis Quaid, who played
Pendleton.
Yes. I guess my last name came from Camp.
You know what? There's no reason to overthink this project.
We found that out.
Well, we found that out deep in my research. Yeah, we really found that out. But anyway, we did what year was it that we did this movie?
It came out in 87. We actually shot it in 86.
Did we shoot for Christmas?
That's true.
We started shooting in the summer of 86.
Wow.
And basically went till Christmas.
Right. That's right.
Yes. In San Francisco and in Los Angeles.
That's right.
Warner Brothers lot. I do.
And up at Island.
And
Industrial Light and Magic, where we did all the scenes with you in the pod.
In the pod, all by myself. With Marty was kind enough to actually.
Well, you'd done the same for me. We would go and do a scene. But Dennis would have to go to a little pod area and just kind of talk to me, feed my off-camera lines.
But that's one of the reasons that the picture works so well, is because, instead of pre-recording it all, which is what used to be done, we had a gizmo that our sound guy, Ken King, came up with, which allowed these guys to be on the set all the time and ad-lib and talk to each other. And the relationship is so much better because of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the comic timing, which I'm still looking for, but at least I could rely on Marty's for that. But anyway, we made the movie in 86. It came out in 87, and it went right to the top. Everyone expected it to be a huge hit.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember, we were already getting congratulations on the Thursday night and the Friday.
That's why they figured they didn't have to sell it because they liked it so much. So let's do a poster that doesn't have any people on it. Let's just do a poster that has a big thumbnail on it.
And
we'll call it Innerspace, which happens to be the same title as the Monsanto ride in Disneyland because we never could think of anything better.
The poster looked like a science fiction movie. With nobody's
no
face
comedy
on it. Nowhere did it say comedy. This is
but
a
it
comedy.
Did say like Steven Spielberg
you
presents.
You hammer that it's a comedy,
which is the important
yes,
part.
Yes, it did.
It still didn't help, but
that's yeah.
Did they have your name at all, Joe?
Steven had been burned by people thinking that he directed movies that he was presenting. And so he insisted that I use a Joe Dante film, which I never had used because I don't believe it. I don't like it. And he said, okay, we'll just do that on the poster. And then the movie will just be regular with regular credits and stuff. And it was the only time I ever had to do it.
So the film came out and I remember, hearing word that it was just
going to be amazing. And then I called you, Joe. Actually, I remember the call right before I was going to travel to Tahiti with Meg and said, hey, man, it's great. And you went, oh, yeah, it would be great. But
I told you to stay in Tahiti.
It just wasn't. Yeah. So, and it just took
a, the phrase the LA Times used was crash and burn. But ironically, it
was well reviewed.
Well reviewed, except for the ones that accused me of misogyny. But later, it was one of the first pictures to come out on DVD, VHS rather, and it was Letterboxd, which is unusual. Oh. And suddenly, it became extremely popular on video, and people started giving it to people. And now it has this tremendous cult following of people who think it was a big hit when it came out theatrically.
Well, yes, everybody thinks it was a big hit.
I don't like to disabuse them of the notion because it sounds good to me, but in fact, it was not.
Well, I have been in India, in the wilds of India, and heard behind my back inner space. And it actually is the number one movie worldwide that I am recognized for, even more than the Mummy Trap, which,
and that's got Lindsay Lohan.
That's all word of mouth.
No, and not only that, I remember being interviewed 3 years ago for the New Yorker, and the interviewer was about 34 or something, and we talked about Innerspace. He said, I loved Innerspace. And he went on and on about Innerspace. And when I told him that it wasn't a big box office hit, he went, what are you talking about? How is that possible?
No, it's inconceivable.
Because in his mind, it was Gone with the Wind.
No, it has a great fan base.
Without the racism.
People just won't accept
because it doesn't seem like it has hit all over. Because truthfully, Joe, you made a great film.
No, it's a wonderful film. It's a lot of fun. I never had more fun making a picture.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that was due to you guys and the rest of the cast. I mean,
having Marty 7 months of fun
and have it be completely different from take one. it was extremely unusual for me.
Yeah.
And then he would beg me in Katharine Hepburn's voice, one more take, Joe, please. One more. And I need one
Come
more.
Come on, Joe. Let me have one more. Spencer would have.
Exactly.
Oh, I don't know, Kate.
John, you're not involved. No one gives a damn. Duke my ass.
Okay. Well, I'm going out on a date with Cary Grant, and I don't know what to
give Cary my best, and he will show you his best, I'm sure.
Yeah, but Marty and I would sit in the trailer. It was a 7-month shoot, joined at the hip, and just comment on what went by our
trailer. It was a riot.
So much fun. We really got to really, really got to know one another. I was there. I had nothing to do but be there for Marty. I would basically just be on a microphone that was, I do believe, right? Yeah, even before Ellen ever thought of doing that. That's the way we
did it. Yeah, that's right. And it was great, too, because then you became eyes to say, you know, I'd do a dance and I'd say, gee, is that too big? And I'd maybe say that to the AD, was that too big? And I'd hear in my ear, no, that was great.
I think you'd ask one anybody. Of the electrical grips.
Absolutely.
Constant need for approval, you know.
And, yeah. Well, at no time in my career have I ever asked, is that too small? No, I believe in freedom takes. I think the gimmick of an actor is that you make everyone love you and think you're the greatest human being in the world. And then so when you weasel more takes out of, like, say, a director, they'll say, okay, he's so cute and lovable.
Let's give him
another one. And then I go home and say, you know, it's up to you. You have so many options. It's up to you to screw me up.
It's true. A lot of stuff is done in editing, as you know.
Yeah. I mean,
you can make a good performance look terrible and vice versa.
Joe, how did the movie come about?
I was approached by Peter Guber, who had apparently never heard of Fantastic Voyage and had been given this script by a guy named Chip Prozier, which was a straight spy movie with this plot. And I said, this plot is ridiculous. You can't expect to make a straight spy movie out of this. And so I went off and did my stuff, and he went off and did his stuff. And by the time it circled back around to me, it had been rewritten by Jeff Bohm with the concept, what would happen if Dean Martin was shrunk down and injected inside Jerry Lewis? And that I understood. I said, okay, I get that. But then Steven Spielberg had become involved. But Steven wanted Robert Zemeckis to do it. And Zemeckis thought it was too much.
Well, he's awfully good.
Well, he thought it was too much in the vein of Back to the Future. Right. So he said no.
Back and to the Future. I inherited thing. It,
which was interesting because I was the guy they went to first. And Peter Cooper was a lot of fun to work with because he was never around. John Peters, on the other hand, was a real pain in the ass. He didn't like the movie. He didn't like the actors. He didn't like me. And he kept going to the dailies at Warner Brothers with the executives and bad-mouthing the movie while it was running in the dailies.
Wow.
I got Steven to ban kind of him from those dailies, and he could have to go into his own dailies, you know, by himself. But I think he was behind the impetus. I love it when executives really understand the movie they're making. The impetus was, you know, Marty Short isn't really that attractive. Don't you think we should get somebody more like Dennis Quaid to play that part? And so there was a lot of behind the scenes stuff going on that you guys weren't aware of, and it culminated in they were all upset about the movie. It wasn't going well, they said, you know, because John Peters wasn't laughing. And so I had a meeting with Steven Spielberg, and he said, you know, what I've been here before. What you got to do is you got to fire somebody. And I think they would prefer that you fire Marty. But since you've already shot a third of the picture, it's probably not a good idea. However, there was this other actor who was playing Mr. Igo, the bad guy, named Luca Bercovici.
Oh, was he a tall guy?
Tall, skinny guy.
Black hair, spiky. Yep,
it was also a director. He played, his father was a writer, famous writer. And he played it as a sort of a Brooks Brothers kind of a guy. And they said, Steven said, we'll replace him with somebody. And so Mike Fennell and I were given the task of inviting this actor to the office to tell him that for no reason whatsoever, he is not going to be in the movie anymore. And it was really painful. Anyway, we end up hiring Vernon Wells, who had been in Road Warrior. And ultimately, of course, it was a better match for the picture because Vernon was very bulky and scary looking, and he played it like Jack
Palance. Yeah, he was very
and
scary.
So right.
And so
yes, he was the guy that put on the vibrator onto his hand. He was
it worked out, but it was painful. You know.
Yeah, he and Fiona made a great couple. Yes, really good comic duo. And so did Marty and I. And I also resist. Marty is a very...
Thank you very much, man. Dennis.
Really. You should see him with his clothes on.
Yeah.
Well, you have, but I haven't. You were in the trailer a long time. So.
We were joined at the hip. Eventually, those two hips have to bathe.
Why did they even start shooting it? Cooper
and Peters were good cop, bad cop. I mean, that was the way that they operated. And I guess John wasn't that fond of this picture, or maybe he came on late, or I don't know what it was, but he just had an animus about it.
Did he read it?
I presume he read it. But, you know, maybe he read Chip Frozier's version. Chip Frozier, who has his name on the picture three times, and I never met. And the one quote I've read from this guy is, I cash the checks, but I've never been able to sit through the movie.
I watched the movie again last night, and I have to say the movie still really stands up. There are set pieces of comedy in this film that are just amazing. The chase scene. I think it was the only chase scene through San Francisco since Bullet. For that they actually allowed cars on the street, and you know, there was my Mustang, you hanging off.
That's right. How safe was that? I wonder.
Well, it was comparatively safe because you had that steel bar.
I did
up your pants, so to speak.
You're telling me.
But we had there's an amazing part of the scene where you like the door swings
right, and then I have one leg in Meg's car.
Meg is in my Mustang. Yeah, yeah. And then you actually kind of are able to let go of the truck and you are perched atop the windshield of the convertible and try to keep your balance. And it's your face. And
no, it was him.
How did they do
that? It was me, yeah.
It was him. There's a-
it was one of the last things we shot before we finished in San Francisco. And there'd been a big party the night before. Like, because, you know, I think we were shooting on the Monday and then we were leaving. And it was a big party. And I just remember that one of the stunt guys are hooking me up. And I could just smell vodka coming out of his pores of his face. I thought, oh boy, this is, if we, you know, it's like, you know, the motto, what do you feel comfortable telling the cops? This is one thing I'd mention. Oh, by the way, I know the stunt guy was reeked of alcohol. Is that, should I have stopped then? Or, oh, well.
Well, they'll never know.
No, they'll never know.
We won't tell.
It really, truly is like one of the most amazing chase scenes. It, you know, a lot of the set pieces remind me of it's yeah. Mad World in a way, the way they came off. And you know, a lot of comedians and comedic actors are used throughout. It's just,
and it's also amazing. It's a 2 hour long comedy, which is really rare.
Joe, I think you told me that at the big premiere in LA, which I was not at, the big screening premiere, because I was already at my cottage in Canada, but that you said that Goober and Peter kept high-fiving each other throughout the whole film, like we did it.
That was at the preview.
Yeah,
the preview. The audience that's preview. Right. This is when they decided it was a great movie. And they're all, and as if they had made it themselves. Oh,
yeah, that's right.
It scored like higher.
Oh, it was
than
insane scores in the 90s. And
the biggest comedy they ever had.
Yeah. Either you or Steven, someone told me that there was a lot of high-fiving. Like,
oh,
wow.
Yeah, no, there's a we lot did. Of high-fiving. They were yeah. all, people have had nothing to do with the picture. We're high-fiving each other because that's the way it works. And then you think, well, you don't have to advertise this. They're just going to come out of the woodwork to see it, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
And, you know, yeah. they reissued it. They reissued it with a different poster.
That's right.
Late in the summer, I think. And, of course, it still didn't. Nobody. By then, it was an old movie, and nobody went.
Yeah.
Yeah, originally it came out, I think.
Yeah, around it was. July. And there was a lot of competition.
I do believe. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the Will Smith. Yeah. Weekend, as it usually goes, and they did reissue it. I mean, that's sort of like what they did with Bonnie and Clyde.
Well, that was after they were told by the critics.
Also a reissue. But yeah, exactly.
Oh, Bonnie and Clyde bomb when it first came out.
Oh yeah, and got terrible reviews.
And they waited for like 4 months and then put it out in the fall, and it turned into a big hit.
Wow.
And largely atop Faye Dunaway's fashion, but it's only time I know.
Yeah, it doesn't happen that often. That
completely changed course.
Well, there's a story about the producers and that everyone felt it was too much, too soon. Mel Brooks, producer, and Peter Sellers saw it at a screening and became obsessed with it. And was making a film in L.A. and would have a Friday night screening of the producers, invite everyone influential. And then it kept building steam. And then I think it got nominated for an Oscar. Interspace won an Oscar for special effects.
The only closest I'll ever get to an
based
Oscar.
On exactly. Marty Short's face.
Those effects are still pretty good today.
They are.
That was Rob Bottin doing that, pushing all that air up into your face.
Meg, who couldn't be with us today, I was, that's too bad. I was thinking maybe the three of us, we could stalker call all of the the women in
Wendy Shaw.
just check in, and we're doing
Peter Interspace Lewis.
2. I wanted to check your availability.
Some of the other actors aren't.
Fiona Lewis, I always see her in Giorgio's, the restaurant.
Yeah. Kevin McCarthy. Yeah,
I love Kevin McCarthy because I love when people have these great stories in their brains, but they also have the wherewithal to share them. And he had so many great stories telling me about working with Marilyn Monroe and the Misfits.
Yeah.
And how they were supposed to shoot at 8:30 in the morning, and she showed up at 5 p.m. at the courthouse. Yeah.
Just right before Elizabeth Taylor shows up. It was always late. You know, but he had some prophetic lines in there, too. I mean, he was talking about
miniaturization. That's the ticket.
We're the new thing. What? That's the ticket. Yeah, it's junk. Not space. That's over. That's useless. Yeah, it's a useless junkyard of orbiting debris. That's what it's going to wind up. Very prophetic. That's what's going on now.
And everything is getting smaller. That one up. It's all nanobots now.
Yes. Hey, me having that Mustang, was that that red Mustang, which it's a hard car to find nowadays. I think it was a GT. Was that a reference to Bullet?
Yeah.
By the way, on the streets of San Francisco, that candy red. It was a beautiful car. I would have loved to have had that as a
ratio. Now you tell me.
But got no rap gifts, I don't think.
what did it do for everybody's career?
I would say probably very little. Marty, had you already made Cross My Heart?
No, I would do that next. I'd made Three Amigos.
Right.
Three Amigos.
And Three Amigos was a box office disappointment. It didn't bomb, but we were second to Golden Child at Eddie Murphy's Golden Child. Mm. So, I mean, again, people don't remember that, but that's what it was. So Inner Space now is like this. Cross My Heart was a small film anyway. So I was basically finishing the movies. Thanks to you, Joe.
You're welcome.
Back to vaudeville for me.
It was at that place where people were actually really starting to rent videos. That was before DVDs. And so you could get it on beta or VHS. But that's
happened to a lot of pictures from the 80s. I mean, the Burbs is another movie I made that was, you know, it did okay in theaters, but then it became this, you know, cult movie, and everybody quotes the dialogue and all that stuff.
But Gremlins, 84. What year did you make Gremlins? 84. And
nobody expected it to be anything, because it was sort of Spielberg's folly. They said, well, he wants to make this cheap horror film, and it's for his first movie for his new company, and but we want him on the lot, so let him do it. And then they saw it and they hated it, and they didn't understand it. And then they had a preview, and suddenly, looks like we can make some money with this. So now it's a classic.
You were like the underdog. You would prove people wrong.
The trick is to try to get somebody who will let you make the movie you want to make and not try to talk you out of it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's their I feel a responsibility. It's their money. It's their project. You know, I'm just trying to do my best. And when they come and they tell me I don't know what I'm doing, which unfortunately they did during the scene in Inner Space where Marty was shooting the scene where Marty goes into Bob Accardo's hotel room and hits him. And I get a call. They come to at lunchtime, they want you to come to the office, the high office. And I go there, and these guys who were very nice, Terry Semel and Bob Daly, they were nice guys. And they said, you know, I just don't know how to tell you. It's just not funny. You know, this picture is just not funny. And we don't know what to tell you what to do, or we don't know what you're doing wrong, but we just thought you ought to know. So, great, thanks. So now I go back to my set,
for the encouragement.
And I'm saying to myself, so am I wrong? Is this like not funny? Am I completely on the wrong track? It was a terrible thing to do to a director. You know, particularly, it's not like you're yelling at him and saying, you asshole, you're fucking it all up. No, they were very supportive. They just didn't understand why it was not good. And of course, in the end, it was good, and they realized that. But at the time, in the dailies, they just didn't see it.
Yeah. How much of comedy do you think is...
Remember with Abbott and Costello, they used to have one camera on just Costello and the other was a two-shot, because they always knew that they had to, in case he did something unexpected, they had to be covered. And that's spatial relationships in comedy is actually pretty important.
Yeah. And with Marty, it's like he does it 10 ways from Sunday. And so you got to be prepared to cut to the pod and me sort of looking around at all my instruments. Yeah, basically with Tuck Pendleton, I relish the role. Looking back at the movie last night, I go like, oh, maybe I thought I was doing something different, but I was actually basically doing Gordo Cooper for the right stuff.
Well, there's only so much you can do in that pod.
Yeah, and that jumpsuit, you know, there's no place to put your hands in those things. So it's always going to be on the hips, you know. And at the time, I was a new pilot. That's the way I approached it. And then there was Meg. Meg and I were not, did not get together.
I remember vividly because it was when we did the junket in Austin in the summer of 87 when the film came out. That's when you two told me that you were involved.
She was with Anthony and I think
that's
right, with Leah during the shooting of that. And there was absolutely zero, you know, nothing. She was so glad to be there. I think she, you know, basically.
Do you remember how late in the movie she joined us? I think she was hired like either the day before we shot or like 2 days before we shot, because there was a big contretemps about who was going to play that part. Well, everybody and every actress in town wanted this part. And there was a particular actress who felt she was owed the part for reasons I won't go into, but I just thought was not right for the part. So I said no. And we scrambled around, and Stephen finally started watching soap opera tapes, because he's apparently an adult.
Right. And that's what she was doing. She was Betsy.
On Life to Live or something like that. Yeah.
Lives, I forgot.
And I think that's where he found her.
She was actually quite popular. Probably more known than
she
you
was
and
in
I
a
were
John Candy movie. Armed and Dangerous. But it was a small part. And she'd also been in Top Gun.
Oh, of course. That was her biggie.
Yeah.
And she had made a movie with Kiefer Sutherland as well. No, I think she did that right after. Anyway, she went to do that movie. And then I went to do Suspect. And then along came a movie called DOA. And they hired Meg for it. So we were in Austin. That's where we got together. And then surprised Marty, because we came down.
Well, you were super glued together by then.
Because we were working.
Right.
Yeah. And
I didn't know.
Yeah, but Marty did know. Everybody in the world knew that Marty.
I was surprised.
But, guys, she's so good at the movie. It's a great part. It was kind of a woman of power.
Yeah. Right?
She was a journalist, I think, after investigating. And she's the one that, you know, gets to pull the gun on the bad guys. And she was very, very tough and matter of fact, the way she handled that gun. Like,
and how about
she
those
knew
shoulders?
What she was doing. Yes, those padded 80s shoulders.
She looks like she's got a hanger. So
I remember one time that Meg and I were supposed to be, she's driving your red car. And we're shooting in San Francisco, and we're supposed to go up to a block, make a right, and go around the circle, the block. But there was a walkie in the back seat. She missed the turn. And suddenly it was the second turn. And now we were into the, the big parade, the Chinese parade with dragons. And you'd hear the AD going, that's it. We're after. We didn't have a clue where to go. It was fantastic. Yeah,
it was like San Francisco.
That was during
time,
the big parade, and we were lost in the parade. You had to send guys out to figure out where we were. And we were in a red car. We didn't know. Meg and I, and anytime we have talked about that film, has only joyful, laughing memories from that.
Well, I think it did really good things for my career. Actually, you know, it was actually like in a real comedy with working with other people who. Working with Marty Short, I mean, who cannot make you look better? It's just easy. I was Dean Martin.
It was a pretty good analogy.
And I think that's really. I think that's.
Oh, you sure was, Dean.
Oh yeah.
You used to do those voices. You used to do those voices.
Yeah.
Yeah. Take a little walk down.
Hey, that would be good, Dean.
That scene where I'm possessed, you know, we reshot that. Where you're in Bill Schaller's office.
You're right.
And you discover you're hearing the voices and you're possessed. So we had originally shot it with, I think, some nameless extras. And you didn't think it was working. And I didn't think it was working. And then we looked at it and we both didn't think it was working. And so your suggestion was, let's get people that we can count on, that we know, to play these parts. And so we got
Joe Flaherty and
Andrea Martin from SCTV. And it's, you know, it's a throwaway scene in it. Well, it's a throwaway scene for them, but they're actually really good at it.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah. It's one of the.
Remember, she kept turning a magazine. She had put in a bunch of those little things that fall out of a magazine, but she put about 18 of them in. So every time she turned, one of those things would fall out. Those little coupons, you know.
This little SCTV. Let's hear it from Canadians. No,
SCTV was always better than Saturday Night Live. It was more intellectual.
Well, it didn't have the pressure of an audience. Approval, you know.
That's true.
We if we thought it was funny, it therefore existed.
And it was also conceptual. I mean, so many
yeah, and it was and, well, you can know. Do. But again, you know, if you try to do conceptual in SNL, and you hear, you kind of go, oh, I guess that's cut. You know, right, in Inner Space. I love that film. There's a lot of scenes. I love the stuff in the grocery store at the beginning. I love when you come out of the pod and the kind of everyone's torn, you know, Meg's torn between these one person she's fallen in love with, but one person she loves. And,
right.
And the music, I love the score. That was a great score. Who did that score?
Jerry Goldsmith.
Who did the score? Goldsmith, yeah. Genius.
Yeah.
So it was, it's but yeah, I have only fond, yeah, happy memories of doing that film.
Oh, every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings.
I don't hear a bell.
No, every time a bell rings, the picture makes another $20.
Yeah. Every time a bell rings, a film doesn't open.
Yeah. I think my favorite scene is where they're having lunch and Picardo is trying to be you.
Oh,
it is you, but it's Picardo. Yeah. It's hysterical on how you change back into yourself. That's,
well, we had Marty dub that entire scene with his own voice. And then we realized that actually it played funnier with Bob's voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
As he actually did it.
It was funny, but yeah. My favorite line is in there. Remember, media means barbecue.
The sauce.
The sauce.
Bob is a lot of fun to work with because he's very loose and he makes a lot. He has a lot of great ideas and he makes a lot of stuff up. And I mean, it is a good script, but there's a lot of good ad libs in it.
Yeah, really great. This is the cowboy, the Middle East,
which you couldn't
cowboy.
Do today.
And there were. Yeah, and we were everybody. We wanted that other chip, you know, for the deminiaturization thing. That's also in that scene that they're fighting over. Now that chip, this is what I don't understand. It's like in today's, you fast forward to today, 2020. That chip looks like a cog or like a burr. It is the strangest thing I've ever seen because I
well, it was state of the art to it
in. Yeah, solid state of the art. I expected, like, you know, a tube to be coming out of these cathode tube, whatever they are. Do you have a favorite scene yourself?
I mean, one of the best scenes is the scene is Marty's dance scene, and that was a reshoot. It wasn't even a reshoot; it was an add-on. After we finished the picture, Stephen decided it needed another piece of action, so we shot the stuff with you going into the heart, which had not been in there, where the, you know, and then we also to beef up the relationship, we brought him back to your apartment and looked at the picture of her, and then he did this dance, which is, you know,
with Sam Cooke twisting the night away, right? That's, yeah, in fact, we have several Sam Cooke.
That's a pretty funny scene.
I do believe, right?
And then I did a shoot before the film opened with Rod Stewart. Remember he sang it?
Oh, that's right. That was a music video, right?
Yeah, I shot a video just before the film opened.
Oh, that's what killed it. That's what killed it.
So it was like, that was in the heyday of MTV, by the way. Yeah. Yeah. And what were you doing in the video, by the way? I would like to know about this. And how come I wasn't in it?
They were going with the money. No, I think that you can go to the YouTube and you can find it. And it's Twisting the Night Away, Rod Stewart, Martin Short. And it's a lot of me doing basically the same dance is in the in Tuck's apartment. It was a whole day shoot. I got to hang with Rod Stewart. I thought that was pretty cool. He was very nice. No, that's when they thought that this film was going to be like, you know, there was Titanic, there is Inner Space, you know.
Yes. Once they got Rod Stewart to do the video, they knew he was going to number one.
We had a chance before we got Rod Stewart in.
It turned into Titanic.
Yeah. to literally the Titanic. I get it.
Oh, man. It was so much fun making that movie. I mean, that's the way I remember my films is not necessarily by how well they did or whatever. I have a completely different reference. It's the experience
They're not all fun.
And this was definitely up there, one of the top five experiences. And a lot of things happened. I mean, you know, wound up with Meg as well. And here's another prophetic scene is when you kiss Meg, right? And so that the pod with me goes into Meg for a short period of time as a comic device, I guess, or whatever. But then I'm trying to figure out where I am, and I guess I'm roaming around her system, and I wind up in her uterus for some reason, and I see a
note,
a baby. With a notepad to say, I see a baby there, and it just so happened that your name was Jack, and that it was just a coincidence. We named Jack Jack.
Oh, it wasn't a coincidence. It was on purpose.
Didn't even catch that until later.
It was a homage to Marty.
No, it was destined. And by the way, what a great name, Jack. Jack Kennedy. You know, yes. Who does the greatest name ever?
That's basically why I wanted Jack, because I myself wanted to be named Jack when I was a kid.
As opposed to Dennis the Menace?
Yes, as Denny. Opposed to Denny or Dennis the Menace or however.
Or even Den doesn't have a lot of strength to it. Hey, Den.
Den.
You don't even want to go into the den of your house, let alone know a guy named Den.
Right, it's just like the devil's den. It's not. It really doesn't work out.
I go by Marty. Marty
for respect, and then go.
I don't know.
Marty,
I remember one time my mother looked at. I was playing piano in a recital. I was in, you know, grade 10 or something, as we say in Canada, and it said, you know, concerto Marty Short, and she went, "I guess he'll never be known as Marty." And so with that in mind, when I became an actor, I said, I'll make a Martin Short, because Marty Short sounded like a comic. Hi, Marty Short. I'm only here 1 week, you know. Martin Short sounded.
Did you see me?
Martin Short sounded like Martin Balsam. It had a little more weight to it. Short didn't help. That was like back to the Irish pub with you.
It's better than small.
Well, like my middle name is Hater. So I used to think Sir Martin Hater. See, now you're talking show business. Assuming I was knighted.
Well, a lot of people don't know about this about you, but you come from a family.
I did. My mother was the first female concert master of the Philharmonic.
Yeah, you yourself.
I played piano for a while. I mean,
you were that's what you were on the road to do. You were like a boy.
Yeah, well, I was. I had some gifts. I could, you could do John Wayne, and I could do K Happen, and we would often, sometimes, if you could believe it, have a cocktail or two or 18, and then we'd be in the bar. Remember one time we were at a bar and I sang Sinatra. I got up in Sinatra and you leaped out of your chair and started dragging me by my feet like you were a fan on the ground. Again, there might have been some alcohol involved. I'm not saying there wasn't. And you were grabbing my legs and trying to pull me off the stage like the ultimate fan. I remember that.
Well, I still am the ultimate fan, buddy. I
always that right back at you, baby. Fan,
that's for sure. I just want to know when we're doing Interspace 3. We'll just skip 2.
And well, you know, it's sort of, it was sort of set up for a sequel. That's how.
Yeah, he jumped in that.
Yeah, what?
That's how happy they were about it. Oh, well, you know, we can. He gets in the car and he follows them, and now it's, you know, of course, then we have to have Tiny Fiona and Tiny Kevin for the entire movie. But
yeah, I think the last lines of the movie were, "Doc, I'm cured. Wendy, no chance. Mr. Morehouse,
I jumped in that car.
I quit." Yeah,
yeah,
and away you went.
That's the last people saw that movie. Get it out. Put in Golden Child 2.
But yeah, I would encourage people to go to their Blockbuster even now. And
what year are you living in? Film. What Blockbuster? It's on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
Was Blockbuster around back then?
And we had the Z channel, didn't we?
Right.
The Z channel.
That's right.
That's right.
That was local.
Wow, I remember that.
Yeah, it was local. But it was exciting to see full movies with no commercials.
First movies on
TV.
See, that was the other thing with Interspace. It was not just, it was these companies that were now HBO and Showtime showing these movies and having people rediscover them as well as the rental.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, that was one.
You know what HBO stands for? Hey, Beastmaster's on.
That's funny.
I don't know if Interspace
not with the cowboy today.
Not with the cowboy. There's several things that are now sort of like politically incorrect. I think.
Hello,
like probably a lot, but including my whole life. It's a film that I think still stands up on its own. And
well, I think it's one of the best things you guys ever did. And I'm not just saying it because I made it.
I really do. And it just has a classic feel to it. Well, my career has been peaks and valleys and peaks and valleys, but that was definitely a peak that came up. If you stick around long enough,
my career is always that I feel that there'll be one word on my gravestone. Almost. And that's fine. That's more than I thought I would have gotten. For years I used to think it was just who's the witch I pissed off, you know. But it's more like almost.
But what do you think it would be like for you now to be starting out in the business today?
I wouldn't be able to.
When we started,
I was lucky that I got in when I did. We still shot on film. We had somebody give you a script that meant there was money behind it, so you had a job. Now you have to, you know, it's all late career Orson Welles. That's the way all are. We just go around asking for money. We were lucky. We were lucky to get to work when we did.
I mean, streaming television is. I think there's a renaissance that's going on in streaming television, which is basically what was going on in movies.
Yeah, but that's right. But 1970s movies have now migrated to streaming. But all the theatrical movies are all big spectacles. You know?
Yeah, and the studios are making, but instead of 40 movies a year, they're making 8, and they all have to be tent poles. And they know how much money they're going to make before they.
That's a machine
because it's programmed. Yeah, and I don't know where the three of us would fit into that.
I don't know. Anymore, I can't believe that we ever end up owning homes.
Yeah, but Marty, you started like out at SCTV, right? I mean,
yeah, I think I was luckier because it was a smaller pond. Toronto was, you know, brimming with a lot of great people, Danny Aykroyd and John Candy and Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara and Gilda Radner. But it was a smaller, everyone knew each other. And it, there was no, like, do I, I'll phone my manager about that. You just said, do I bring a suit or not? I mean, you just said yes to everything. So you ended up getting a lot of practical experience on front of camera, but no one had heard of you. So you could take that down to the States with a pretty good resume and a pretty good film reel already. And yet no one knew you. Yeah.
From the television show, from the television show, which was broadcast all over Canada. Yeah. And finally,
but I think that that gave you more confidence. But I think if I'd been just dropped in Los Angeles at 22, I don't know. Because I wasn't going to be like a 51-year-old waiter. I was going to give it a couple of years, assuming that nothing would work. And so that at 50, I could look in the mirror and say, what if you tried being an actor? Oh, that's right. I did. And no one hired me. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think you missed your calling, though, in a way. And it's still possible you could come up with a Victor Borger routine.
Doing kind of that note thing that that Chico Marx. Yeah, no, I could. There's a lot of different things.
Yeah, you know, he's trouble with his seat.
Oh, yeah, seat. Who needs a seat when you can hit the deck?
Comedy. And it's
most of it. Most of it. Some things slip out, and then you just you're canceled.
Just can't help it.
You're canceled.
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I'm 40 years down the drain.
Well, you know, it's funny with satirists. I mean, that is a thing with satire, is that satire makes fun of the person that would say such a thing. I mean, that's the traditional of satire. You know, you make fun of, you play the racist on stage, but you're actually making fun of the racist. But that's, you can't do that anymore. Don Rickles was not a racist, but he was kind of satirizing the guy that would say these things at the end of the bar.
Do you think you could do Archie Bunker today?
Oh, he would.
No, I don't know.
I don't think so either.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. No, because it would have to be funny, and you can't be funny talking about
Carol O'Connor was a perfect example. There was no one more liberal and left than Carol O'Connor, but he understood how that brain worked, and it was brilliant writing, and it's one of the great characters ever.
Yeah.
And the perfect foil for Rob. I mean, wouldn't that be a perfect situation right now, a situation comedy right now where, you know, Archie's a big Trump supporter and Rob's saying, are you insane? You know? Yeah. Drink the ammonium.
Well, I think we would have found,
I guess so,
some show business thing. We'd have been playing Holiday Inns and or Holiday Express, as they call them now, I guess. Hey, guys, I really loved getting together like this, and it's...
You should. I have a podcast. We could go on my podcast.
We should stalker call.
Absolutely. You have a podcast?
I have a great podcast called The Movies That Made Me, and it's, we talk to people not about their careers, but about what movies made them want to do what it is.
Well, who are you talking to? Let me guess who was on your last show. Meg Bicardo and Wendy Shaw.
No, we haven't had any of those people.
Oh, okay.
Guys, I've had such a great
All right, handsomes. Love you.
Anyway, I love you.
Bye.
I love you guys. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks, bye.
Thanks for
bye.
Coming on. Take care.